good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, December 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from St. Peter's Church, Albany, a traditional Anglican church, choir, leading worship services, now auditioning for the Children's Choir School at Adult Choir. More information at stpeterschurchalbany.org. Sports medicine today on Medical Monday. We welcome Dr. Jason Friedman of New Vance Health. Dr. Friedman treats a wide range of conditions, including traumatic musculoskeletal injuries, overuse injuries, concussions, athletic participation, clearance. He has a particular interest in exercise physiology and improving the health and performance of competitive athletes. You got a question? Give a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us is Dr. Jason Friedman, a board-certified physician in sports medicine and emergency medicine with New Vance Health. He treats a wide range of conditions, including traumatic musculoskeletal injuries, overuse injuries, concussions, athletic participation clearance, and Red S. Dr. Friedman provides medical support at various events, including the New York City Marathon, and is also the team physician for SUNY New Paltz sports teams. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jason Friedman, welcome to the show. Thanks for making the trip.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. You can call me Jay.
Jay?
Yeah.
That's how you... All right. I'm going to find out. It's Jay. All right. I'll write that down. Don't worry. I'll forget. What's Red S?
Red S. Red S stands for Relative Energy Deficiency in Sport. So that's a diagnosis that we use to kind of examine athletes who are, especially endurance athletes, who are not fueling their athletic pursuits efficiently. So this is a kind of a chronic condition where people who are putting out high levels of exertion over a chronic or long period of time and then aren't getting themselves enough fuel to really support what they need to do. Over time, they can have all kinds of problems, from endocrine problems like problems with their thyroid and their adrenal glands. They can have real performance decrements in terms of just not being able to really perform up to their full ability. And they can have problems in terms of bone density. Women can have problems with their menstruation. This was more commonly previously known as what we call the female athlete triad, where it's kind of mix of women and endurance athletes who were women who, you know, often had problems with anorexia and didn't menstruate and had low bone density. But we've expanded that term, or that term's been expanded, because it's a problem with male athletes as well, who can sometimes over focus on their weight and not fuel efficiently.
All right, well, how do you quantify Red S?
Yeah.
What markers are you looking for? Is it a subjective thing?
That's a great question, and it can be a tough diagnosis to make, because there is no one specific test that's going to kind of point us in or kind of confirm or rule out that diagnosis. It really is a kind of a holistic kind of thing, where you have to talk to the athlete about, you know, A, what are their concerns? Are they just, you know, sometimes we'll see people come in with, I'm training as hard as I've ever trained, and my performances aren't, matching up to the type of effort I'm putting in training. So that's one of the questions where we have to ask, you know, well, that could be a lot of different reasons. Let's talk about what are you taking in? Let's maybe have you meet with a nutritionist, maybe have you meet with a sports psychologist. Talk about, if it's a female athlete, what are your periods like? How is your menstruation changed or not changed? How is your weight changed or not changed? How is your training changed or not changed? And, trying to match up. And also, it's difficult, not just physical stresses, but emotional or mental stresses or work stresses, family stresses. These are all kind of things that can sap our energy. And again, if we're not putting in we're not taking in enough calories, we're not taking in enough energy to support that. If we run this negative balance over time, we can see these these negative performances or these, you know, issues that can persist.
It really must take a deep dive to get to that point where you say, oh, you have red S. I mean, it couldn't it ever be, oh, you're a lousy athlete.
you never really want to go into that the patient interaction, I think, with the
oh, you have good bedside manner. Oh, I see.
But no, certainly, yes. This is a type of diagnosis that takes some time. It takes, you know, as we say, a high index of suspicion. You have to be thinking about it. But you also can't anchor on it. You have to say, right, what other things are out there? You know, let's look at your sleep schedule. Could you have something like Lyme disease or some sort of inflammatory problem that could be contributing? So, again, there are different biomarkers that we look at, but none of them are you know, it's not like we get an X-ray, you broke your wrist. It's
right.
You know, there's no one test that's going to tell us yes or no.
When did this become a thing, man?
So people have been talking about things like this for a long time, again, particularly in the context of what we call the female athlete triad. And, you know, we've long recognized that endurance athletes, or athletes in general, but, you know, this is particularly prevalent among endurance athletes who lose their regular menstrual cycle. Are at risk for low bone density, poor performance, and all this sort of stuff. So that's been around for a while. It's only in the last probably 10 to 15 years, 10 maybe, that we've kind of called it red S and kind of, you know, maybe overcome the stigma that this is a female-only issue and that men can have this problem too.
We're joined today by Dr. Jay Friedman, who is a board-certified physician in sports medicine and emergency medicine. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the email bag and then the phones, quickly, tell us about some of your duties as a team physician for the SUNY New Paltz teams.
Sure. I'm the head non-operative team physician for SUNY New Paltz. We have an orthopedist who, you know, we call in when there's a problem that requires surgery.
Right.
You know, I'm responsible for, you know, working with the head athletic trainer to kind of make decisions for athletes' healthcare. You know, the athletic trainer is really the kind of first stop for most of the athletes when they have an injury or, you know, an illness or something like that. And I'll come in when, you know, they need the next step. If they're doing some rehab with the athletic trainer, it's not kind of progressing, or if they have an acute injury that the trainer needs help with diagnosis. So I'm usually on campus once or twice a week, examining athletes and talking to athletes who, you know, the trainer wants me to see. And, you know, then we'll, you know, make determinations on who needs, you know, x-rays or MRIs, might need surgery, that sort of stuff. And it's fun because it's really, you know, most of us in sports medicine enjoy working with, you know, higher level athletes.
Yeah.
and they're motivated to get well and perform. And also it's very collaborative with, you know, people in student health and the trainers. So it is a lot of fun. And then I do a little bit of the game coverage for them, just, you know, being on the sideline, just helping out if there's an issue. It's not, you know, there's no football program there. So that's
right.
For most sports medicine physicians who do a lot of game coverage, football is kind of the primary thing. So we don't have that,
I was going to ask you about concussions, but if you're not doing football, it's probably not as common. It is. Okay,
yeah.
Well, you know, I watched a lot of football this weekend, and you see the tense and the talk of concussion protocols.
Mm-hmm.
And just briefly, and I do want to get to the emails here, tell us about how the standards have changed. In the old days, back in the 60s, 70s, player got his bell rung. He was back out there. There was no problem. Now they go into a tent. If there's any question, they're out of the game, sometimes for weeks at a time. How has the standard sort of clearance level, how's it changed?
Yeah, it's a great question. The number one thing I think that's changed is awareness, right? Is, like you said, in the old days, you know, they talked about, right, you got your bell rung and you know, you shook it off. And what we've come to realize is the pathophysiology or the interplay of what's going on behind the scenes when that actually happens. And, you know, a concussion is not something that we can see on CAT scan or MRI, but it is a brain injury. I mean, it's a low-level brain injury. And you know, our recognition that we need to kind of treat that with respect is the main thing that's changed. So to have a defined protocol now, or a more defined protocol, is a big change. So, yes, I think there's work to be done in terms of, you know, having independent physicians making decisions as opposed to people who are employed by professional teams that, you know, might be motivated by different reasons to get people back into games and such. But no, now, you know, there's a lot of good studies that are kind of defining return to play protocols. And so there is a good protocol that most NCAA schools abide by, which outlines, you know, the types of activities that you can do and the milestones that you have to hit on the way to returning to play. And it's, you know, with especially with students and even with the athletes I, or the patients I see in my private practice who come in with other concussions from, you know, falls or motor vehicle accidents. It's not just about returning to play or sport, but just, you know, concussions can have a lasting impact on just our day-to-day lives, you know, the kind of things that we can and can't do at work. You know, things that we like to do for leisure, you know, reading, watching TV, working on the computer.
Yeah.
People with concussions can have challenges with that. So, it is a, it becomes a kind of a case by case basis of, you know, kind of really bringing people along gradually and making sure that they're, you know, kind of hitting the checkpoints that we want them to hit to ensure that we're going to do it safely.
We're joined by Dr. Jay Friedman today from New Vance Health. It's sports medicine and emergency medicine today. You ready for a couple emails?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, this one's from James. About 2 years ago, I think I tore a bicep tendon in my right arm. Mostly hurts my upper forearm. I'm a regular exerciser, and I'd like to keep that up. Do you think PRP therapy will help heal it?
That's a really great question and a little bit of an advanced question, but that's great. So PRP, and you know, I want to preface this by saying without knowing specifically what
right.
your injury
yes,
is, obviously.
Of course.
But in theory, yes, PRP might be an
it's
excellent
platelet
choice.
Replacement?
It's called platelet-rich plasma. Yep.
Okay. And so what exactly are we doing there?
Yeah. So platelet-rich plasma is what we call a biologic treatment where it's using the body's own natural healing mechanisms to help heal injuries. And the way that platelet-rich plasma works is we draw blood, just like a regular blood draw. We draw, you know, depending on the injury or the what we're treating, usually about maybe 60 milliliters of blood. So, you know, certainly less than if you were going to donate blood.
Yeah, not
that
much.
Yeah.
Right.
More than a standard, you know, blood draw that you would get for a lab test or something, but a reasonable amount.
Okay.
Then we spin it in a centrifuge, a special centrifuge for about 20 to 40 minutes or so. And what that does is separates out the blood components by density. And then the centrifuge removes out the layer that is the what we call the platelet-rich layer. So the blood, obviously, there's plasma, which is kind of the fluid that everything's
right.
in. There's the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and the platelets, and then all these little proteins and other things that are in the plasma. So we target the layer that basically doesn't have any of the red blood cells and maybe has some white blood cells, but mostly has platelets. And
yeah.
what goes along with those platelets is also all these like growth factors and proteins and stuff that are involved in healing injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And then we inject that at the site of the injury. And that could be into a joint if there's arthritis or something like that. And oftentimes that's into soft tissues or around tendons to heal tendon tears, ligament tears, you know, muscle tears or something like that.
Wasn't there a time when this was, you had to go to Europe to get this done?
Yeah, Kobe Bryant had this done. He was one of the first kind of famous athletes who had this done. He was would fly to Germany for this procedure in the early aughts.
All right, well,
much more standard now.
Let's take a quick break here. We're a little overdue. Dr. Jay Friedman joins us today. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll get to the phone calls and more emails in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. Jay Friedman joins us from New Vance Health. It's sports medicine today on the program. And let's go to Leverett, Massachusetts. Stacy, you're first.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, Stacy. How you doing, kid? We're here.
I'm good. Okay. Sorry about that. So my daughter is an athlete. I think she's probably been running more lately. Anyway, she's developed like a bump. It's almost like a cyst on the outside of her I guess, her like pinky toe on the side of her foot. It happened about a year ago and then went away, and it's back again, and she's about to go to a foot doctor, but since you're on, I figured I would call and see what your thoughts
cool.
might be on it.
And the foot doctor's next week, so just bear that in mind, Stacey. All right, go ahead, Doc.
Good to know.
So, Stacey, is this, is it pouching out from the skin? Does it look like a blister, or it's more like deep under the skin there?
No, it's more deep. Yeah. If I didn't know any better, I'd say like it was a bone, but when you touch it, it's like not a bone, but it's not really soft either.
So it's kind of firm. Is it painful?
Yeah, it's uncomfortable. And,
uncomfortable.
You know, when she's ice skating, she can feel it, or when she's in her ski boots or something like that.
Sure, sure. So something that comes and goes like that, I mean, I'd have to say most likely is a cyst. And a cyst can kind of swell up when it accumulates with fluid, and then something can, you know, it can kind of reabsorb, or it can kind of, you know, something can happen. You can pop it, and then, can kind of reabsorb or reaccumulate over time. So, yeah, I mean, I think she's obviously definitely get it checked out, but, it does sound probably like a cyst, like a ganglion cyst or something like that.
Okay.
And is that, like, the remedy for that? Is that generally rest, or is it something that gets removed surgically?
So, presuming that that's what it is, it's not something where you would need to necessarily rest or anything. It's certainly activity as tolerated. So, if it's bothering her to the point that she can't do things, then you don't want to kind of make it angry,
yeah.
so to speak, but
yeah.
you know, it,
right.
it's not something that I would anticipate causing any long-term damage. If it is a recurrent kind of problem, then you know, surgery to remove it would probably be the kind of easiest thing to just not have it come back again, because like I said, they can recur over
right.
time, and that would, you know, typically be a, you know, pretty quick procedure. I wouldn't think more than an hour and a pretty quick return to play.
Stacey, thanks a lot for the call. It's Dr. Jay Friedman today on this edition of Medical Monday. Sports Medicine, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag in a little bit, but let's go to Olive Bridge. Heather, you're on.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a veterinarian who specializes in acupuncture, and I was really curious, doctor, if you either employ or recommend acupuncture for performance and recovery with your patients and the team members.
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely, I do. And there's a lot of kind of what I would kind of categorize as maybe adjunctive treatments or therapies that I talk about with a lot of my patients. Acupuncture being one of them. Certainly, we talk about massage therapy, active release therapy, which is kind of a deep tissue chiropractic technique. And I talk about a lot of these with different people because, some people respond to some things and more so than others. But I found acupuncture can be really, really helpful in terms of, especially in terms of like soft tissue injuries and such. I'm not sure that I necessarily could give you the mechanism by which it works. I think anything that kind of stimulates blood flow to injured areas and kind of brings in that natural healing response is kind of a good thing. And I do think that's probably the way, at least from my understanding or our understanding of Western medicine, how we can kind of best explain that. A lot of the things that we do, even things that we talk about in the clinic, like dry needling and things like that, are kind of working on that same principle of just bringing blood flow to the area. So I do talk about a lot of those things with my patients. I don't do most of them. I'm certainly not certified in acupuncture, but I have a kind of a few people locally to me that I do recommend if people are willing to try that sort of thing.
Heather.
That's really great to hear you. I'm in Ulster County as well. We've got a lot of good practitioners, and I could certainly explain to you the mechanisms by which acupuncture relieves pain, but it's not my show. So thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Heather. And, in the new year, we will have Dr. Chris Dallas on our Pets and Vets, and she is an expert in Eastern methods.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, she's really great. And, you know, the great thing about working on pets, you're not really going to have any sort of placebo effect. If it works, it works.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. Yeah.
This email from Sherry, or it could be Cherry. Either way, it's a sweet name. About 1 month ago, I had a PT treatment in which the therapist did gentle manual traction, pulling my leg and ankle, trying to help with body skeletal alignment. 2 days later, I had a slight pain when turning my ankle inward. Then 2 days later, I had substantial swelling. X-ray showed no fractures, although I do have significant osteoporosis and in my late 70s, never had ankle issues before. It's being called tendinitis, but it's not getting much better, and it hurts with any pressure on ankle bone and continues to swell and hurt after standing or walking too long. I've used the Rice method without any relief. Any thoughts? And that's from Sherry, I guess.
Thanks, Sherry. Yeah, that's a good one. I wonder, you know, I'd be curious on your X-ray if there's any arthritis in your ankle, you know, in terms of in the joint itself, if there's any signs of kind of wear and tear or cartilage loss. Because when we get kind of pain over the joint or over the bone without, you know, an associated fracture or anything that we see on X-ray, especially with swelling, kind of a flare-up of arthritis is one of the things I would think of. Certainly, you know, Rice is one of the things that we would, you know, meaning rest and ice, compression, elevation are things that I would use to. Yeah, that's kind of one way we would want to address that. And then, you know, strengthening exercises to kind of take pressure off the joint sometimes can really be helpful. You know, it's again, obviously, these are hard questions to answer without being able to examine you on my own. But that's one thing I'd consider. Tendinitis is a possibility or a muscle strain or something. And sometimes those do take some time to heal. You know, the ice and compression and rest can help in the short term when we're having a lot of pain and swelling. But when things get a little bit more chronic, for lack of a better word, or persistent, then it really is important to start working on range of motion and kind of making sure that we're not getting too stiff, or, you know, kind of using that ankle as tolerated, you know, with some support, maybe an ACE wrap or a brace or something like that. But we do want to get that swelling to go down, oftentimes by using it some and, you know, making sure that we're not getting too stationary.
We're joined today by Dr. Jay Friedman. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a sports medicine question, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Why do athletes at the end of games jump in an ice tub, which sounds like absolute torture? What does it do?
So that's a controversial topic, I would say.
Why?
So, because the studies haven't really shown that to necessarily be effective. And also, we're not quite sure, you know, the mechanism by which, or if the kind of thinking behind that actually holds water in terms of recovery. So an ice bath, that's kind of a recovery technique.
Yeah.
Where we're trying to, you know, or athletes are trying to decrease inflammation and speed recovery that way. I mean, problem number one with that is while it can, and this is coming from somebody who, when I ran in college, we used to get in the ice bath after every hard workout, so twice a week, and I can confirm it's no picnic for sure. But you know, we talked a little bit about the placebo effect. It did make you feel better for sure, and you know, did that, you know, help us recover faster and run fast or harder in our next workout? Maybe. The studies that are out there don't support that's anything more than a placebo effect in that case. Now, the thought is, you know, the other reason that's controversial is, you know, again, what you're trying to do with ice is decrease inflammation, decrease swelling, that sort of thing. You'd hope you'd get back to performance faster. The problem is when we're training in sports and athletics, part of the training response is you're breaking down your muscles and then rebuilding them stronger, right? So if we are putting ourselves through a big workout, we're breaking down our muscles, and then we're blunting that response of all the inflammation that's going to help us kind of rebuild those muscles and be stronger, well, then we're kind of counteracting some of the exercise we just did. At least that's the theory.
Can I infer then that perhaps sauna is better?
So that comes, you know, everything comes with a balance, certainly. Sauna can be really helpful in terms of mobility. So people who have problems with joint stiffness, muscle stiffness, that sort of thing can help improve blood flow there. You know, and there are a lot of benefits to the sauna in terms of like heat adaptation and helping our boost our red blood cell production and that sort of thing. I don't know that I would necessarily say a sauna is... you know, I don't think we need to supercharge our kind of inflammatory response with a sauna after a big workout. But there's definitely a role for sauna in training and especially, you know, for athletes who are getting ready to perform in a hot weather environment, or, you know, even for endurance athletes who are looking to boost their performance, there's some suggestion that using a sauna regularly can be have a similar effect to like training at altitude.
All right. Well, I never liked saunas much, but a nice warm whirlpool at the end of a athletic event is nice.
Yeah.
All right. So this is from Zoe. I had ACL reconstruction 9 months ago, using my quad tendon as replacement. I'm still very sore and swollen daily and wonder, is this normal? What can I do to improve? I've done PT for 3 months and I continue to be physically active. And that's from Zoe.
So, I'll try and answer as best I can. This is a little bit beyond me because I'm, you know, a primary care sports medicine physician. So I don't do orthopedic surgery.
Right.
You know, I'm involved a lot in the diagnosis and certainly ACL reconstruction that goes through orthopedic surgeons. So they can talk more knowledgeably about the recovery from an ACL surgery. What I'll say is 9 months after ACL, I to my understanding is not out of the realm of possibility to still be having some of these symptoms. Generally, ACL reconstruction is a 9 to 12 month recovery.
Hmm.
So if you're still having some soreness and some swelling intermittently, I don't think that's a reason for undue concern necessarily. I think we would like to see some progress with the physical therapy, certainly. And that can be measured in a lot of different ways, your range of motion, your ability to withstand load, your muscle strength, particularly in the quadriceps muscle, that sort of thing. If we're seeing progress there in those kind of metrics, but you're still having some symptoms, I think that's probably a reasonable kind of pathway to recovery. If you're not really seeing progress in terms of your strength, your range of motion, your balance, that sort of thing, and you're still having pain and swelling, then I think that's more of a cause for concern and probably something to address with your surgeon.
We're joined today by Dr. Jay Friedman, a board-certified physician in sports medicine and emergency medicine with New Vance Health. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Now, doctor, this is the time of the show where we go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania, and we say hello to Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim. You're on.
All right. These sitting exercise machines advertised on television, are they much benefit?
What are the sitting exercise machines, Doc? I've not seen these. Maybe
yeah,
I'm not
Jim,
watching the
what,
right shows.
What exactly are you referring to? Like a rowing machine, like an erg, or something more like a weight?
It's supposedly mainly for the legs, knees, and
They're like ellipticals you sit at. They're under the desk. I've seen those ads.
Oh, I know what you. I see. Right. So I'm not sure what the purported benefits are, like what claims they're making there, Jim. You know, in general, I think something like that, you know, is going to be helpful in terms of, I would say, A, just some range of motion stuff, right? Making sure that your knees are, you know, I'll kind of go off on a little bit of a tangent here. So when we have things like knee arthritis, hip arthritis, people tend to move less because it's painful and they get stiff. And the stiffness is one of the worst things that can happen with people with arthritis. I tell my patients, the more we move, the better. So in that respect, if this is something where you're having knee pain, swelling, tightness, just stiffness or difficulty with initiating movement, then that's absolutely something that can be helpful. And maybe they burn a little bit of calories too, you know, more so than just sort of sitting stationary,
right?
Obviously, you know, moving your muscles a little bit. Beyond that, I mean, if something like that, if they're claiming, you know, that it's going to help with osteoporosis or cardiovascular health or anything like that. I'm not 100% sure. For osteoporosis and bone strength as we age, that sort of thing, weight-bearing exercise is really the main thing. So I don't think that would necessarily categorize.
Jim, thanks a lot. We'll take a quick break here. Dr. Jay Friedman is our guest on this edition of Medical Monday. Sports Medicine Today at 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. Take it away. So, you know, it's the end of the year, and listen, if you've listened to public radio for a long time, you know, oh, God, they're asking for money again. Well, this is the end of the year. And if you value what you get at WAMC, you get that journalism you can count on. You have no paywall ever on the website. It's a giving season. If you have the wherewithal, throw a little gift our way. It's a year-end thing. You can donate at WAMC.org, or you can call the main office. I'll give you the number once, but it's not the number for this show. It gets confusing. 800-323-9262 is the number of the main office if you want to make an end-of-year gift. But you can do it online at WAMC.org. And we thank you in advance. I know it's... Listen, this is a terrible time to ask for money because everyone's buying presents for everybody else. So do what you can, and thank you in advance. Now, back to the show. It's Vox Pop. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. Jay Friedman joins us. And, you know, we're talking sports medicine and stuff, and the phone lines are pretty jammed at the moment. Let's just grab a couple of emails, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Karen in Kingston. Wonder if the good doctor, that'd be you, knows what to do about sore and at times painful, here's a word I can't even begin to pronounce. Ischials, I-S-C-H-I-A-L-S, is that
Ischials?
It? Ischials.
Yeah.
It's a long-term problem and was told it's because I don't have adequate fat in my butt, a.k.a. Weaver's bottom. Would physical therapy help? And that's from Karen in Kingston.
Sure. So,
ischials?
So the ischium, that's kind of the bottom part of the pelvis, basically, where your hamstrings attach.
All right.
Your sit bones, as they say. Can physical therapy help? Sure. And I'm going to presume that, Karen, you've tried things like sitting on a pillow or a donut or avoiding hard surfaces, that sort of thing. Physical therapy is the first line for a lot of what I see. And certainly in this case, kind of strengthening our gluteal muscle, strengthening our hamstrings can be helpful.
Yeah.
This kind of gets into some of the, be as aggressive as you want to be, kind of things that, you know, I've worked with physicians who have done things like trying to just inject dextrose or another, dextrose being just like sugar, basically.
Yeah.
Or just an inert substance around the ischial bones, just trying to kind of cause the body to almost form like a little bit of scar around it, so they have like a little bit of natural padding there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of a novel approach
to
that
sort
of thing. Can she
get buttock implants that I've heard so much about?
Yeah, probably.
Would it help?
Maybe.
From that weaver's bottom? All
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And certainly if you look long and hard enough, you'll find somebody that'll tell you that they'll inject PRP right there and that'll do them. You know, that'll take care of everything. But, you
Make
know, there
sure
are
they
people
have their medical license first.
There's going to be people that are going to tell you, pay your PR work for everything. So, I don't know about that.
All right. This is from Richard in Kingston. I broke my femur 3 years ago. Also had to replace a hip, resurfacing. The leg is always slightly swollen from edema, I presume. Is that normal? And is there anything I can do to help? By the way, I'm a very active 77-year-old male former bicyclist. And that's from Richard in Kingston.
Yeah, so absolutely, that's not unusual to have some leftover edema after a large surgery like that, hip surgery or femur surgery, that sort of thing. The main things that'll help are going to be, as you said, Richard, staying active, you know, keeping that motion up to, you know, especially in the lower extremities, our blood flow is really dependent on activity because there's, we're going against gravity, right? So it's actually the constriction or contraction of the muscles in the leg that kind of force a lot of the blood flow back up towards the heart. So we need to kind of make sure that we're consistently engaging that mechanism to kind of keep moving our blood through. And, compression stockings and stuff like that to kind of force fluid out of the tissues and back into the vasculature can be helpful. And just staying strong and staying active is the main thing.
All right, one more email for now, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from regular correspondent and great pal Christine in Watervliet, who says, why don't all high school, college, and pro players wear the reinforced helmets? I watched a game recently, and only one player wore one. What's she talking about?
Yeah, so this is, there's been a lot of discussion and study and kind of R&D around some of the wearable technologies to protect against concussion with different types of mouth guards, different types of neck guards, different helmets that are, you know, that people are investigating to see if we can decrease the incidence of concussion. The reason why right now is twofold. One is there's not yet enough, to my knowledge, there's not yet enough research that supports that these reinforced helmets or these extra padded helmets are statistically decreasing concussion incidents enough to kind of mandate that their use is mandatory, basically.
Is there enough data yet?
Not yet. That's kind of the issue. And then, you know, the other one would be cost. I mean, even if and when we do show or develop some technology that's going to do that, you know, the cost implementation, especially at the high school level, like you said, there is going to be one of the main barriers. But the main thing is, right, there's no one technology other than really wearing a fitted mouth guard, you know, as opposed to not wearing one.
Right.
But there's no other, and maybe possibly some neck protection, but there's nothing really that's been shown definitively to reduce concussion incidents, and that's why you're not seeing it adopted on a widespread basis.
Christine, thanks for that email. Back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Dr. Jay Friedman joins us from New Vance Health, and let's go to Shelburne Falls. It's Lynn's turn. Lynn, go ahead.
Yes, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Excuse me. I tuned in at a point where you were talking about concussions, and I just wanted to share that I had a concussion, and I lost my sense of smell. It kind of was an odd thing. It came on rather quickly. I hadn't noticed it. I said, oh, I can't smell anything. And I lost it for about 2 years, and that's a little bit longer than usual, I think, but I thank heaven I think I've got it mostly back. I wonder, things don't taste the same, but anyway, that was the little thing I just wanted to share. I do have one other thing. I fell on my right lower kind of kidney area, lower rib, about 3 months ago, and I cracked a rib, and the thing was spasming like crazy for quite a while. And then just a couple of days ago, remember last week, I was going down the back steps and I slipped and fell on the exact same spot, and that felt really good. Anyway, so it's been spasming, you know, just spasming. And when I did take the muscle relaxer, it did not help my intestinal tract.
Ouch.
Is there anything, is there heat or cold? What should I be putting on it at this point?
Yeah, great question. So rib injuries can be really annoying because we talked a little bit earlier about the Rice method for dealing with acute injuries where you kind of rest it, elevate it, compress, ice. That doesn't work very well on the ribs. You know, if you sprain your ankle, it's easy to kind of compress it and elevate it and stay off of it. But your ribs, your thorax, your rib cage, you're not really able to adequately rest that or stay off of it. We're always breathing. We're always turning and moving. And we're not doing any additional damage to it, but we're always kind of aggravating that injury. And that's why these injuries can kind of persist and take a long time to heal. Lynn, in your case, I would say, especially several months out, you know, certainly there's a role for ice and if it makes it feel good in terms of decreasing inflammation. But I think the main thing we're trying to do with the muscle relaxers is to get those muscles and that spasm to kind of calm down. So heat is probably the way to go for the most part. I do often have my patients alternate ice and heat, do 15 minutes of each, but the heat will really bring the blood flow to that area and allow some of that spasm to resolve. And then some of the things we talked about before, like some massage, some acupuncture and stuff like that, that are going to kind of keep blood flow going to the area and allow you to move around a little bit more freely will help. But for the most part, this is the kind of thing that it just takes time, and it's a pain, but it takes time.
Lynn, thanks a lot for the call. Our guest today is Dr. Jay Friedman, a board-certified physician in sports medicine at New Vance Health. You know, every time one of my kids twists an ankle or whatever, always, Dr. Mom, oh, we got to alternate cold and heat. What does it do?
Sure.
What does it do?
So the cold, the ice, that's anti-inflammatory, right?
Right.
And, you know, we want to be careful because inflammation is the body's way of healing. Like when an ankle swells, that's the body trying to immobilize it in its own way so that we don't injure it worse. But that can be painful, and counteracting that with ice to keep swelling down, keep inflammation down, can help. Particularly, so I like, you know, for the first 24 hours, 48 hours, something like that, 72 hours, ice for an acute injury like that will really help. After that, especially as we start dealing with achiness and stiffness and that sort of thing, heat is really, really helpful in terms of, like we said, bringing blood flow to the area, bringing healing products to the area, allowing those muscles to relax and that sort of thing. So oftentimes I have athletes and patients, even non-athletic patients, where I'm doing that kind of alternating ice.
But you're
and
doing
heat
it
kind of thing.
Over the course of days,
yes.
Not hours.
No.
So cold first.
Cold first.
Okay.
Yeah, for an acute injury, cold first. And then, you know, some people say always heat after. I like ice and heat after.
Yep. All right. Dr. Jay Friedman's our guest today. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 to Clifton Park. Danny. Danny, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 67. I'm a former collegiate athlete, very active my whole life, very active senior athlete right now. In the last 18 months, almost every joint in my body, major joint, has become a problem. Over the last 72 hours, it's my hands. And I'm told that I have osteoarthritis.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's more to the story, like endocrine or rheumatology. What do I need to do to get my doctor to get some traction with him to give me a referral for further investigation?
Uh-huh.
So great question. Certainly you may have osteoarthritis, and you can have osteoarthritis all through your body, which is kind of like just wear and tear, you know, loss of cartilage, that sort of thing. You bring up a great point, Danny. When I see that in, like you said, kind of everywhere, you know, multiple joints at the same time or, you know, both sides of the body in all kinds of joints. I do think it bears investigation for an underlying issue. Like you said, a rheumatologic issue possibly. So, you know, obviously in this area, untreated Lyme disease can lead to arthritis, although that's usually more of a monoarthritis. But things like lupus and other things that can cause inflammation, especially if you have a family history. So the main thing I would say is, you know, with your doctor, I would say, raise your concerns. The fact that it's been, you know, kind of ongoing for quite some time, it's been kind of moving around or going into different joints, and just say, you know, what are some things that we need to investigate so that they can start with some basic blood work to look for inflammatory disorders, and then maybe a consultation with a rheumatologist. Those can be kind of hard to get into because there aren't enough rheumatologists around.
Really?
So, oh, yeah.
Why do you think that is? The money's got to be good.
The money's good, just like the money's fine with everybody else. It's just, right. There's.
Well, hang on, you're talking to a broadcaster, yes. So it's not everybody else.
No, I'm saying all everyone right. in medicine. Like we're all doing
okay.
Fine.
Yes, great.
It's just the inherent rewards in the system. You know, that are there for some specialties.
And so rheumatology is something
where if kids out there, if you're interested in medicine, think about rheumatology. It's a really fascinating field. We do need more of them, especially in our area, in the Hudson Valley. I mean, Clifton Park, you might be a little bit better in the Albany area around AMC. You know, down by me in the Mid-Hudson Valley, you might wait 6 to 12 months to see a rheumatologist, unfortunately.
Danny, thanks for the call. Let's go to East Moncton, Vermont, and it's Mark's turn. Mark, you're on.
Yes. So I was wondering, we have a concussion like as a kid. Can that cause head shaking later on in life?
What do you mean by head shaking, Mark? Tremor?
You just start shaking your head. Not a tremor, just, like a habit. You see some people just kind of shake their head out of a habit. I had this when I got a concussion. I was on a hay wagon, on the top of a hay wagon. I was young, and this girl was just kind of coming at me. I went right out the back, and I fell on my back. By the time I was 12 years old, this happened when I was probably 8, I was shaking my head like crazy, and I had to focus. I mean, it was one of the hardest things I ever had to beat, but I beat it.
That's a new. I'm not sure that I've not heard that associated with concussion before. I hesitate to say never with anything in medicine and biology, but that sounds kind of like a tick or something like that, rather than something that I would necessarily associate with a concussion.
All right, Mark, thank you very much. The number here is 800-348-2551. Laura writes in, can you share the best protocol for dealing with sciatica pain? How long does it usually take for sciatica to subside? And that's from Laura.
That's a great question. So sciatica is something I see in my practice a lot, even though I try not to because I'm not a back specialist.
Okay.
The back is a tough one. So for those who don't know real quick, just the sciatic nerve, there's one on either side, and they come out of multiple nerve roots in the back, and they run down your legs and supply a lot of pain signals and such from the lower extremities. And it's very common to have shooting pain down the legs from irritation of the sciatic nerve, and that's usually coming from irritation somewhere in the back or in the buttock or something like that. So. As we talked about a lot of different things there, Laura, physical therapy is one of the first things that I approach sciatica with. And the idea there is we're not going to change your anatomy or anything like that. But what we're going to do by strengthening the muscles in the back, the core, the gluteal area, is we're going to improve your posture and your mechanics and the way that you move. And hopefully that will help to relieve wherever the pressure on the sciatic nerve is coming from, so be that from a herniated disc or some arthritis in the back or something like that, and generally that approach combined with some anti-inflammatory medication and then some of the other things that we talked about, acupuncture, massage, ART, all can be very helpful. But sciatica unfortunately can be the kind of thing that comes and goes. It's something that we can manage and kind of keep under control with a lot of these things. But in many cases, the underlying anatomy doesn't change there. So it may be something that you're susceptible to. And the main thing preventatively, again, is just staying strong, staying mobile, staying flexible,
right,
and keeping the core and the back muscle strong.
And I believe next week, I think Tuesday maybe, we have a physical therapist, Matthew Goodemote, is on, and he's a back guy.
And we
can talk about that a lot.
So absolutely.
Hang in there, friends. Quickly, now we only have about a minute, to Ballston Lake. Robert, you're on.
I want a Jiffy Quickie Do method for alleviating the discomfort associated with rotator cuff.
Okay. We only have 45 seconds, Doc.
Great. So rotator cuff, we're running the gamut from just basic strains to tendonitis or overuse to partial and complete tears of the rotator cuff. So it's tough to give you a one-size-fits-all answer, but certainly for most problems, physical therapy and strengthening, some anti-inflammatory medication. This is a role where I like to use cortisone injections judiciously as a strong anti-inflammatory, and PRP for partial tears can be very helpful in that sort of thing. There are a lot of different ways to kind of address the rotator cuff, but physical therapy is going to be one of the main ones there.
Thanks a lot, Robert. So cortisone, is there a limit, lifetime limit, on how much you can take?
So not specifically. There's no hard and fast rule, but cortisone can have negative effects over the long term on joint and soft tissue if we repeat it too often. So it's not a situation where it's just like you can only get X number of shots, but certainly when we're very careful about doing repeat injections into the same site, certainly spacing them out over time so that we don't weaken the tissues or worsen arthritis or anything like that.
All right. Well, Dr. Jay Friedman of New Vance Health, we're done. Well done, sir. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwangunks near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency waitlist available. WoodlandPondNP.org. Thanks again to Dr. Jay Friedman for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. A couple of foot and shoe questions were among those still on hold at the end of the show. Just so you know, podiatry on Monday with Dr. Douglas Tooman from Hudson Valley Foot Associates. So that can happen. Just call in on Monday and call a little earlier and we'll get her done. The number, of course, is 800-348-2551. You know what? Write it on your wall and we'll get those foot questions on Monday. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Bob Rathbun, just a suave, debonair phone screener over there. Well done. And some off-color comments on the computer. Thank you very much. Tomorrow, it's history with Rensselaer County historian at Hart Clewitt Museum head honcho, Kathy Sheehan. We'll see you, too.